Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon producing. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. So today, at long last, we are going to talk about Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner. Or should I say, Ernest Hemingway versus William Faulkner. Was it a friendship or a rivalry? How did Hemingway feel about the man he once called lousy with talent? And was Faulkner's criticism of Hemingway really criticism after all? We will examine the way their lives, their works, and their interactions, including their pettiness and their bickering, all combine to allow us to examine their legacies as two great pillars of 20th century American literature, side by side. And joining my puny, inexhaustible voice is a great Faulknerian who will help us with this effort. Ahmed Honaini is an honorary research associate in American literature at Royal Holloway, University of London. He is the author of William Faulkner and Mortality, A Fine Dead Sound, published by Routledge in 2021. He is the founder of the Faulkner Studies in the UK Research Network and the associate editor of both the Faulkner Journal and the Journal of American Studies. He has published widely on Faulkner in relation to, amongst other topics, European literary history, Vladimir Nabokov, and Ernest Hemingway. Ahmed Honaini, welcome to One True Podcast.
Lovely to be with you today, Mark. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Well, we wanted to have you on for such a long time, Ahmed, and you and I met, of all places, in Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
Indeed, my first trip to America and my first international conference, and what a conference it was. I have lovely memories of that trip to this day.
So your first trip to America was to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. That's not too many people can say that.
Yep. No, sure. And the TSA agent actually said, you're coming to America for the first time and you're going to Missouri. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, good luck, buddy. So, and it was a fantastic trip. I got what I wanted out of it. So,
and the people were great. So we love Missouri and we love Cape Girardeau. Well, as I mentioned, Ahmed, we've long wanted to talk about Hemingway and Faulkner because they are such mighty subjects. And what I often get, and whenever his name comes up, is that there is a sort of a dichotomy. You either like Hemingway or you like Faulkner as a reader. Of course, some people do scholarship in both, but it's almost like Hemingway's style and Faulkner's style are so different that you almost have to choose one or the other. Is too much made of that?
I think it is, because what you need to understand is that there is a lot of interconnect between them. They're both writing about very similar subject matters. They're writing about gender, about sexuality, about mental illness, amongst a whole plethora of other topics. And I think that to sort of, pigeonhole them as in, being antithetical to one another isn't very fair. And I know that we'll be discussing how they intersect during this podcast. But even on the topic of war, they're both very interested in the topic of war and war trauma and, Great War veterans. Their first major novels, Soldier's Pay by William Faulkner and The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, are about the aftermath of the First World War. So I don't really think that it's accurate to say that, they weren't on the same page either thematically or philosophically.
So that invites a perfect question, Ahmed, because 1926 is the same year that The Sun Also Rises for Hemingway and Soldier's Pay for Faulkner comes out. And what similarities or differences do those two novels have? Is it helpful to read those two novels in concert?
They are. I certainly have. I've published an article on as a kind of a comparative piece between wounded soldiers, as in Jake Barnes and Donald Mann, trying to find a semblance of home and stability after the aftermath of the First World War, and the central female characters at the heart of both of those novels, Lady Brett Ashley and Cecily Saunders, having to, in a sense, rehabilitate these wounded soldiers, and them essentially failing to do so because they themselves are victims of the war in their own way. So I think, you know, that there are, between those two novels, there are so many different kinds of overlaps. There's, you know, modernist experimentation. There's references to, say, for example, song lyrics of the time, of different kinds of pop culture.
The perception is that in 1926, with The Sun Also Rises, Hemingway sort of found his voice and was able to reach some level of popularity. Faulkner, even if we're going to look at this in retrospect, not in the sense of books sold, but in terms of finding his voice, was The Sound and the Fury in 1929. And you look at The Sound and the Fury, at the Benji chapter that starts it, or the Quentin chapter, and you just say, well, these are the polar opposites of writing in the 1920s. We could even say A Farewell to Arms was published in the same year, or the same season as The Sound of the Fury. These couldn't have been published by two more different writers.
I've always been of the opinion that The Sound and the Fury, certain portions of it, such as the Quentin section, read almost as if they're a parody of Hemingway's style. And if you will allow me, I'd like to read two passages, from one passage from The Sound and the Fury and one passage from The Sun Sure. Also Rises, that kind of illustrate that comparison. Okay, so we'll start off with The Sun Also Rises. This is the scene after Jake Barnes has had this big, you know, argument with Brett at the back of a taxi. She loves him, but she can't be with him. He goes home to his hotel and he just, you know, he's wallowing in his misery. Undressing, I looked at myself in the big mirror of the armoire beside the bed. That was the typically French way to furnish a room. Practical too, I suppose. Of all the ways to be wounded, I suppose it was funny. I put on my pyjamas and got into bed. I had the two bullfight papers, and I took the wrappers off. One was orange, the other yellow. They would both have the same news, so whichever I read first would spoil the other. Now, turn to Sound and the Fury. This is the very beginning of the Quentin Compson's section, which, spoiler warning, his entire chapter in The Sound and the Fury is him preparing and finally succeeding in committing suicide. I went to the dresser and took up the watch, with the face still down. I tapped the crystal on the corner of the dresser and caught the fragments of glass in my hand and put them into the ashtray and twisted the hands off and put them in the tray. The watch ticked on. I turned the face up, the blank dial with little wheels clicking and clicking behind it, not knowing any better. Jesus walking on Galilee and Washington not turning lights. So as you can see, there are, you know, The Sound and the Fury seems to be almost mimicking, you know, the way that Hemingway in The Sun Also Rises is very meticulously walking you through what Jake is doing, how he feels, why he feels that way, what, you know, how his actions and his emotions kind of intersect. And then you have in The Sound and the Fury, Quentin meticulously going through the steps of destroying his grandfather's watch in order to get himself mentally prepared to commit suicide. And obviously, with Jake Barnes, he is in a state of complete and utter mental anguish after the war and because of the dysfunctionality of his relationship with Brett. So it seems almost as if there's no way of proving this, because I looked through the library catalogue that Faulkner has in his home in Roanoke, Mississippi. There is no copy of The Sun Also Rises amongst that catalogue. But I would like to think that, you know, in an ideal world, Faulkner was aware of The Sun Also Rises and was kind of giving a little dig at Hemingway, the kind of the very telegraphic style in which he, you know, he says, okay, Jake does A, then B, then C, then D.
Can we also extend that to say, so Quentin is preparing to commit suicide in that entire long chapter, but he never really comes out and says it, nor does Faulkner ever describe it. So is that in a way, because I think the common thing is Faulkner gives you too much and Hemingway gives you too little, but aren't there also moments, and we always talk about the iceberg theory, Hemingway's theory of suggestion or implication, but Faulkner may also be using that same mode in that chapter?
Certainly, and the fact is that suicide in the early 20th century was seen as a completely taboo subject matter. You couldn't talk about it, let alone engage in it, and actually to end your life was seen as a kind of, you know, a cardinal sin in the Catholic Church. And so it makes total sense that Quentin, being from the, you know, from a very rigidly traditional Southern background, keeps those emotions very close to his chest. The same way with Jake Barnes. He is totally and completely in love with Brett, and yet he can't bring himself to write down what her behavior, her infidelities with the bullfighter at the end of the novel, for example, what that does to him. He swallows those emotions. He keeps them in, or if he doesn't, if he can no longer hold on to them, he either drinks himself into oblivion. And so we see the cumulative effect of those, of his repressed emotions come out through his drinking. Or we can guess at how he feels, but only by reading through the blanks. He doesn't really come straight out and say, what Brett is doing is hurting me. And I don't think that would be in any way a kind of, an aesthetically, useful way of putting things. But it would seem to me as if, we come back to this idea of there being similarities between Hemingway and Faulkner, and what they're both trying to get at in these two novels, The Sun and the Fury and The Sun Also Rises, is the idea that pain, whether mental, physical or otherwise, can't be communicated. That it has to either be shoved to the margins or just completely denied altogether. And so in that sense, and in many others, I think that there is a definite overlap between their themes and their exploration.
To look at another example of that, what would you say about As I Lay Dying, the next year, 1930, where a lot of times we talk about, when you think about Faulkner, you think about the Civil War. But here we are talking about the way that Hemingway and Faulkner both addressed the World War I. And if you're going to think about the iceberg theory about how returning veterans are treated and described and even psychoanalyzed, what would you say about Darl in As I Lay Dying? Is that a Hemingway-esque treatment, or does that take the iceberg theory and make it exponentially more powerful? How would you categorize it?
Absolutely. I think that, well, first of all, at least with something like The Sun Also Rises or A Farewell to Arms, you are aware of the war constantly. It's always there. It's a movable feast. It's always with the characters that Hemingway is writing about. And As I Lay Dying, there is very little in the way of actual direct mention of Dobb having ever even been to the war throughout the majority of the novel. There are references to him, for example, having lain beneath a strange roof thinking of home. Or there are people that call him queer and think that, well, you know, he's just strange. If he gets married, you know, a woman will sort him out. That he'll be fine. All he needs to do is just get laid, right? But right at the very end of the novel, Faulkner has Dahl specifically mention, actually, that Dahl had a little spyglass he got in in France at the war. In it, it had a woman and a pig with two backs and no face. I know what that is. And that reference to Dahl having been at war is at the moment when he is being carted away to the Jackson Mental Asylum. So there is a constant connection between what we were talking about with mental and physical trauma arising from the war also have it also find in Hemingway also finding itself in As I Lay Dying. So there's a sense that that Dahl's problem, his dilemma, isn't just the fact that he's not married and he needs to get into a relationship. There's something actually much, you know, more deeply entrenched into his psyche that none of the people around him, certainly not his family, who are more concerned with getting their Maharadi Bundran into the ground, none of them are really concerned with what he's going through. And so they kind of, again, they push all of this trauma and all of this pain to the background. And what happens is, Dahl essentially loses his mind. Dahl loses his mind. And there is no sense of saving him. And in that sense, you also have, connections to, say, for example, Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, wherein another returned World War veteran on the other side of the Atlantic, obviously, but he also is losing his mind and nobody is listening to him and nobody is trying to understand him or can even, you know, is even capable of helping him. Or even somebody like Krebs in Hemingway's short story. You know, everybody says, oh, you know, Krebs, he just needs, you know, just let him get out there. Just let him see the world. He'll be fine. But it's not, but what Hemingway and Faulkner and also writers like Virginia Woolf are saying is that you can't just, you know, you can't just palm people off. You can't just say that, you know, their troubles aren't, you know, are insignificant. It's, you know, they need real, solid, genuine psychological help. And the only way that writers like the modernists, like Faulkner and Hemingway could, you know, sound the alarm in a way was to draw attention to it through their literature. And, you know, that's, so yeah. Again, I think going back to the original question, I don't think, you know, to say that they're two completely antithetical writers, that's nonsense.
Well, one thing I'm getting from your answer is that, so if Krebs in Soldier's Home and Dahl in As I Lay Dying, if Faulkner's narrative is a little bit more chaotic and Hemingway's is a little bit more, let's say, understated or matter of fact, both of them have things that the reader really has to be attentive to, because you can read As I Lay Dying and never know that Faulkner is suggesting that that the cause for Dahl's either madness or lack of integration into society is that his war trauma.
Exactly. There are 15 different narrative voices in As I Lay Dying across 59 chapters. And so it's very easy to sort of miss that detail. But once you have that detail of Dahl's war experience and of his ensuing mental illness, suddenly everything makes sense. And what Faulkner is trying to get you to do is to pick up on those details. And if you don't pick up on it the first time, that's perfectly okay. The book isn't going to go anywhere. It's a material object. You can come back to it 2, 3, 4 times. He even said during an interview in the late 1950s, the interviewer, Gene Stein, asked him, you know, people think your writing is so obtuse and so difficult to parse. I've read, you know, people have read it 3 times and they still don't understand it. And he said straight up, well, then read it 4 times. And I don't think that, you know, it's humorous. Yes. And it is a bit, you know, it is a bit mischievous, but there is a kind of, you know, a logic there. And I say this, you know, with the full acknowledgement that I am a card carrying Faulknerian who has spent years reading him. So I fully endorse his answer, but, you know, take a chance with him, you know, revisit him. Don't just, you know, somebody that I was speaking to a few days ago said, you don't listen to your favorite song or a piece of music once and think that you absorb it all. You have to listen to it repeatedly. So yeah.
A couple other things about their work, and then we can go into their personalities and their lives. One narrative that comes up is the bear. That comes to mind, the bear from Go Down Moses, which on the surface would seem like, okay, well, here's something Hemingway could get behind, right? We have the bear, and if we take something like The Old Man and the Sea and compare it with the bear, are we in the same ballpark here, or do you see there? Can you talk about their similarities and differences, the overlap of the Venn diagram with those two narratives?
I do. I think in this particular case, I'm going to have to disagree with you, because I think that The Old Man and the Sea is much more a sort of a lament or an elegy for, you know, somebody who is on, you know, who is at, you know, the very end of their life journey. They have Santiago has one more fishing expedition to make. He has to make it, and, you know, he has to bring home the goods, right? The bear is actually the inverse of that. You have the young male protagonist, Ike, having to find the bear and having to sort of, you know, go through the motions of continuously trying to come to grips with him throughout his life. It's not just isolated to one particular moment in his life, as in with Santiago at the end of the novel. So I think that in that case, they're kind of, in that sense, the function of both of those novels is flipped. The bear works as a coming of age tale and a kind of a full length Bull Dungeon Man. The Old Man and the Sea, as I've said, works as an elegy. You know, you have the ambiguity of the ending. Is he really sleeping and thinking of lions, or is he, you know, moving, passing on to the great beyond? You don't really know.
What about the way that the object is portrayed, the marlin and the bear, and the way that the hunters identify in the object? The way nature is treated in those, and the force of nature is treated in those, is that a similarity?
Oh, certainly, the sense that both the bear and the marlin are ungraspable, that there are things that man cannot control. You know, you can keep moving towards this kind of end goal in mind of always wanting to catch the ultimate fish, always wanting to bring down the big brown bear, and never being able to, because there are some things that man just can't, you know, that are both tangible and intangible. They're kind of, you know, they're of this world, and then they're also larger than life. And so it's a matter of irony, I think, that what Faulkner and Hemingway are talking about, they're talking about, again, as I've mentioned, the intangible, the ungraspable, the things that we think we can control in nature, that we can tame, but really, in the end, they tame us. Santiago, at the end of The Old Man and the Sea, is so completely exhausted and so, in a sense, demoralized by having gone on this expedition and come back with his hands empty, that, you know, again, Maybe I'm giving the book a too pessimistic read, but I think it's almost as if, you know, you tried, but in the end it didn't happen, and that's okay. You know, your reward is that final sleep.
One thing about The Old Man and the Sea that I think about in context with the bear is that Hemingway doesn't name the marlin the way that Faulkner names the bear. That is important. I think it's like the difference between Moby Dick or the whale, right? It's to name it identifies it. I think that's quite important. The other thing that, Ahmed, I'd love for you to talk about is there's that section in the bear that people want to skip, or when it was published in Godin Moses, which is the ledgers, right? Where it's a extremely demanding history. This is something that Hemingway would never put in a narrative.
I think the temptation to skip that particular section is because ostensibly it doesn't have anything to do with the main thrust of the novel. But what it does do is it gives you a very sort of very clear and very concise bottled history of slavery in Yoknapatawpha County. And so if we're sort of following the logical conclusion of trying to tame what cannot or should not be tamed, there is a distinction made, I think, between the bear and the legacy of slavery. Trying to pin down to oppress people or objects or animals that you should just leave be, yeah. That you should just allow to exist.
if we can look at one more text, do you think that The Snows of Kilimanjaro is the most Faulkner-esque narrative that Hemingway ever wrote?
Certainly, because it seems as if it's... Well, first, it doesn't have a linear structure. It's jumping around between different, you know, past, present tenses, past, present time shifts. It is also the tale of a man on his deathbed dying and telling you his life story and wanting to be heard, to have his story told, in a sense because he wants to, stop death from happening, but also because he understands that death is inevitable. And that there is no sense of being able to circumvent it. All you can do is sort of tell your story and then make your bow. In a way, and this comes into a little bit of my own research, I've always thought that a lot of what Faulkner is writing about, like The Sound and the Fury, like As I Lay Dying, even stories like A Rose for Emily and Go Down Moses, is about the idea of having to face your death. About speech being a way of telling the story of your life, about having to come to terms with your own mortality. And that's in a sense what Harry is doing in The Snows of Kilimanjaro. He's coming to terms with his own mortality. And he doesn't communicate his ideas in lucid or telegraphic sentences like a character like Jake Barnes does. His sentences are very long and they're sometimes very hard to pass. And it's almost, there's actually a point in the story where he says something along the lines of, I wish I could have said it all. And in the same way that Faulkner said, he wants to put everything between one cap and period, but you end up failing because you can't really get at the sort of the juice of what you're trying to say. All you can give is your best estimation. So what you want to come across is a kind of a big, you know, a big summation or a big philosophical rumination on the idea of death really just falls flat. And so I think that's what happens in the Snows of Kilimanjaro. Harry doesn't really say anything that is profound. But what we do see is his life experience. And I think that the experience of living, the experience of life itself is what is most profound in that novel, in that short story, as it is with Faulkner's soon to be dead characters that I talk about in my book.
Right. And so, yeah, your book, William Faulkner and Mortality, A Fine Dead Sound, it would also seem like it would invite comparisons of how Hemingway and Faulkner deal with, first of all, the perspective of death from the characters. And, you know, one of the most famous examples in Faulkner is the metaphor in As I Lay Dying, My Mother is a Fish, that Vardaman says, which may be one of the most famous sentences Faulkner ever wrote. So I know that Hemingway would never have written that exact sentence, but what is Vardaman getting at? What's Faulkner getting at? And how foreign is that to us as readers?
On the face of it, it's completely foreign because we don't necessarily, when we think of death, we don't necessarily want to compare our loved ones to animals, to fish, for example, as Vardaman does. But you have to understand in the context of As I Lay Dying, Vardaman is a very young boy. He's a child. Faulkner doesn't tell you his exact age. And so he's never come to terms with death before. He's never experienced it. And he's never been able to, you know, it's a complete mystery to him. And so the best way he can come to terms with death is by earlier in the novel, before his mother dies, he is ordered by his father to go fishing, find a fish and cut it up into pieces for dinner. And as he's cutting it up for pieces, cutting it up to pieces for dinner, he sees its blood, and the blood drenches his body. And so when he sees his mother, pass away, and she looks at him in the moments before she does, he suddenly comes to the startling conclusion. My mother is a fish. My mother is no longer alive just as the fish isn't. Now, when you're in the thick of reading the novel and you're trying to get your head around all of these different perspectives, when you see that sentence, you think, what is this? What is he talking about? And that's kind of the point. And because it makes sense to Vardaman, but it doesn't make sense to you. So what Faulkner is trying to ask you to do is, through the process of rereading, you go back, and look at Addie's death specifically from Vardaman's point of view. And once you begin to see through his eyes, through his perspective, you suddenly begin to think, oh, I get it. So because Addie is no longer here, because mother is no longer here, and because the fish is gone, therefore they've gone through the same, through the same thing. They've gone through the same, through the same, experience. And so therefore, you know, they must be connected in some way. And that actually reminds me of a passage in, Hemingway's A Natural History, of the Dead, in which he says that the first thing that you found about the dead was that, hit badly enough, they died like animals. Some quickly from a wound you would not think would kill a rabbit. They died from little wounds, as rabbits die sometimes, from 3 or 4 small grains or shot that hardly seemed to break the skin. Others would die like cats. I do not know, but most men die like animals, not even men. And so what Hemingway is doing in that passage is essentially doing what Faulkner is doing in As I Lay Dying. He's drawing an equivalency between death being something that is completely alien to us, something that we know is going to happen to us, but we don't know when and we don't know what it's going to feel like, with another part of our lives that is also alien and that is also othered, but that we are surrounded by every day. We're surrounded by pets. We're surrounded by animals, rabbits, cats, fish. And so you have to reduce this gigantic topic of death that is such a mystery into what on the surface looks like something that is completely incomprehensible to you. And so it takes a little bit of getting at, but I think that As I Lay Dying and Natural History are working on precisely the same wavelength there.
One also gets the sense that Vardaman is probably not getting the kind of grief counseling and emotional guidance that he should be getting in the Bundren family. I just wanted to tack on to that because your explanation made me think of it. I think I can even argue that this could be Hemingway's most famous passage, which is the moment in A Farewell to Arms where he says, I was always embarrassed by the words sacred, glorious, and sacrifice. We've spoken about that. And what does he compare the sacrifice to? The stockyards at Chicago, if nothing was done with the meat except to bury it. So we have these, I mean, this is, you know, Hemingway's not being glib by making this comparison. It's a devastating comparison. And so to have Vardaman do the same thing, it's comic, but in the most tragic of ways. So I really love that explanation. This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are excited about the fall 2023 issue with guest editors Ian Marshall and Margaret E. Wright Cleveland, where their theme for this issue is Hemingway in Black and White. It's a fascinating collection of voices tackling a wide range of issues related to Hemingway and race. For this special issue and back issues, please visit HemingwaySociety.org/journals. This episode is brought to you by the Left Bank Writers Retreat. Our friend Darla Warden is leading an amazing literary retreat to the cafes, parks, and museums of Paris. Through walking tours and small group workshops, participants will discover more about Hemingway's Paris and their own. This year, the Left Bank Writers Retreat will take place from August 31st to September 6th 2024, and is limited to just 8 writers. So act fast. Visit leftbankwriters.com for more information about the details of this unique experience and how to register for it. leftbankwriters.com. Let's shift and talk about their lives and how they intersected. So, do we know when they became aware of each other, and when this, if this is a rivalry, when it began germinating?
So Hemingway was certainly aware of Faulkner with the publication of Death in the Afternoon, where he makes that jibe about you have to, you know, you always have to be on the lookout for Faulkner's works, because once he's published one novel, he'll immediately publish another one. So he's certainly aware of him, of him then. The first time that they seem, at least on record, at least what we have so far that has been officially published, that they corresponded with each other, was in 1947, when Faulkner was at the University of Mississippi Creative Writing class, and he was asked where he would rank himself with other contemporary writers. And this is his answer. One, Thomas Wolfe. He had much courage and wrote if he didn't write as if he didn't have long to live. Two, William Faulkner. Three, Dos Passos. Four, Ernest Hemingway. He has no courage, has never crawled out on a limb. He has never been known to use a word that might cause the reader to check with a dictionary to see if it is properly used. Five, John Steinbeck. At one time, I had great hopes for him. Now, I don't know. So,
wow.
A man of Hemingway's stature, and also his ego, when once word of this ranking came back to him, he was infuriated, because he seemed almost as if, well, first he didn't understand what he had done to deserve such in England we call it a dressing down of somebody, you know, of such a critique. Number two, there's a sense that Hemingway had been a kind of begrudging champion of Hemingway, of Faulkner's work. In 1946, the Portable Faulkner is published with an introduction by Malcolm Cowley, and Cowley in 1944 had published the Portable Hemingway. And there's actually a letter from Hemingway to Cowley that says, yeah, you should publish the Portable, because he really Faulkner does deserve this attention. He's a brilliant writer, but I wish that he was a bit more disciplined. I wish he was a horse that I could break and tame and sort of make him, you know, a much more malleable writer. And so what Hemingway does in his consternation and his fury with this letter is to ask his old war buddy, Buck Lanham, to send a letter saying to Faulkner, no, this guy is actually brave because he's done A, B, C, and D on the battlefield. And so I don't think that you're being really fair to him by saying that he has no courage. And Faulkner is mortified. First, because he didn't know that his appearance, the transcript of it, was going to be published. He thought he was saying it confidentially, and so there would be no danger of essentially bad-mouthing a bunch of major 20th century authors to a creative writing class. So he immediately sends a letter to Hemingway saying, I'm really sorry, it was a complete misunderstanding. I don't think that you lack courage in terms of your war experience. I just think that you don't actually go out on a limb as much as you do. So in a sense, he's apologizing, but he's also doubling down on what he said, you know. And then Hemingway replies, and the gist of it is, it's okay, it's fine, we all make mistakes, we're bros. And he literally uses the word bros in the letter.
I am your bro.
And when I was rereading it, and when I was reading it for this podcast, I was thinking he would have fit right in the 21st century. So yeah. So after that, there's a kind of a begrudging respect and a grudging familiarity between the two authors. And then things become, from Hemingway's perspective, they become very bitter when Faulkner is awarded the Nobel Prize in 1950. the first thing to understand about Faulkner is that up until about 1946, with the publication of the Portable Faulkner, Faulkner wasn't on the same level as Hemingway by any stretch of the imagination. Hemingway was a literary celebrity with one major novel after another coming out from 1925 to 1950. Whereas Faulkner, you know, he writes a string of what we now consider to be masterpieces, but at the time he was essentially living and writing in obscurity. He had no money. He had no real reputation to speak of. And that changes, as I've mentioned, with the publication of the Portable Faulkner. And from then on, he becomes much more esteemed, from 1946 to 1949, the year that he wins the Nobel Prize. He becomes much more esteemed, much more well regarded, and he becomes, you know, kind of a cornerstone of American letters at the time. Hemingway, however, at that time, in 1950, Faulkner's win of the Nobel Prize coincides with the critical savaging of Across the River and Into the Trees. And so you must imagine how it must have felt from Hemingway's perspective. You know, I'm this literary superstar, this literary titan. Faulkner's this, you know, this, farmer working in the backwoods of Mississippi. Suddenly he's winning the Nobel Prize and I'm getting Across the River and Into the Trees, what I think is a masterpiece, completely, you know, torn apart. And so it's this reversal of fortune, and Hemingway can't really understand, you know, what went wrong. And so from then on, he just starts making these constant jibes about Faulkner in his correspondence.
Ahmed, there was also one other thing that I wonder if you could comment on, and that is, it seems like, and to reread this now, it's almost comical, but he says, if I could paraphrase, I wrote a letter of congratulations to Faulkner and he never wrote back. Like, it's like not getting a text back from somebody that you like or something like that. It's like, that's why I mentioned, it's like, is that a little petty, or did Faulkner owe him the courtesy of a response? It seemed like that gnawed on Hemingway that he never acknowledged his magnanimity.
Now, sure. As far as we know, Faulkner denied ever having received that correspondence. And in fact, in 1953, when Hemingway wins the Nobel Prize, in the letters, he did write him a short correspondence, a short telegram, but crucially, what Joseph Blotner, the editor of those letters, says, it is unknown whether he actually sent the telegram or not. And so it seems as if, okay, maybe actually Faulkner was a bit sore at not getting a note of thanks from Hemingway, sorry. And so he decided to do the same in kind 3 years later. So once Faulkner wins the Nobel Prize, anything to do with Faulkner from Hemingway's eyes constantly revolves around the Nobel. He makes these jibes about, you know, in correspondence to Harvey Bright, sorry. Faulkner's going to criticize me because I'm not a Nobel Prize winner. And he constantly uses the Nobel Prize as a sticking point to sort of vent his spleen on Faulkner. But of course, the irony is, once he wins the Nobel Prize in 1953, suddenly all references to the Nobel attacking Faulkner are gone. They are gone from all of the correspondence. You can't find a single reference to it in the letters that we have so far. Maybe the Hemingway Letters Project will unearth some unknown treasures in that regard. But there is, however, this constant animosity towards Faulkner. In 1953, I think August 1953, he writes to Harvey Bright, and he says, Faulkner is a creep. Never trust a man with a southern accent. They speak well, but they could speak better English. And so it just seems, okay, so now you're attacking him because he's a southerner. There's a constant need to attack Faulkner, all because of, ostensibly, you know, of a silly ranking done in 1947 that Faulkner never intended to become public knowledge.
Well, if you could, let's say, read both of their Nobel Prize acceptance speeches, would each of the writers be paranoid in thinking that they were being alluded to? Is that just something that we might be thinking about because we're hyper-conscious? Can you at least characterize what Faulkner said that Hemingway might have been addressing Hemingway and vice versa?
From Faulkner's perspective, the idea of endurance, which he mentions repeatedly in the Nobel Prize address, "I believe that man will not merely endure, he will prevail. He is immortal not because he alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance." So the idea of endurance is at the cornerstone of Faulkner's themes as a writer. It's the very last line of the Compson Appendix that was published in 1947, to summarize how the Gibson family in that novel, the only African American family in that novel, how they experience life in the years after the novel takes place. Hemingway, on the other hand, writes that things may not immediately discernible in what a man writes, and in this sometimes he is fortunate, but eventually they are quite clear, and by these and the degree of alchemy that he possesses, he will endure or be forgotten. For a true writer, each book should be a new beginning, where he tries again for something that is beyond attainment. He should always try for something that has never been done, or that others have tried and failed. Then sometimes with great luck he will succeed. So you have this sense in both speeches of the idea that literature is a form of literary immortality. It is a way of enduring both as an artist, but also as a figure of worth in society in terms of a cultural consciousness. Philosophically, again, I think that they're on the same level. I think that Hemingway certainly is responding, at least tacitly, to Faulkner in his Nobel speech, because the similarities and the points of reference there, the points of comparison, are too obvious to me and too overt to be just coincidental. And again, I think that in one sense, Hemingway is trying to one-up Faulkner. He's trying to say, well, it's not just good that you endure, you have to endure and survive otherwise, or, you know, what's the point of enduring anyway? And in another sense, Hemingway is trying to say, well, at least in the speech, if we take it as a response to Faulkner, well, you know, we see things essentially, we're essentially eye to eye, so I don't necessarily see why this rivalry and why this bad blood between us needs to continue. So, I mean, that's assuming that Hemingway was actually charitable in that sense and still didn't want to, sort of finally seeing the Nobel Prizes, as him finally having a victory over Faulkner.
In Faulkner's speech, where he says that modern writing is poetry of the glands, as opposed to the heart, as if is there something maybe that doesn't have the kind of a spirit or dignity or divinity. Who else could he be talking about besides Hemingway and Hemingway's ilk? Is that something that perhaps a sensitive Hemingway might have felt called out on?
Potentially. I mean, because in one sense you have Hemingway as being this kind of hyper-masculine, very sort of very corporeal writer. Everything is always figured through the body. Jake Barnes's castration, for example. On the other hand, for Faulkner to say that writing, that poetic writing is not of the glands, well, it's very hard to say when one of his most famous novels ends with the castration of a black man during a lynching, or in The Sound and the Fury, the Benji Compson is also castrated because of a misunderstanding between him and two young girls at his home fence. So it seems almost as if, in that sense, if you were going to read it, if you were going to read that line as a subtle barb or a jab against Hemingway, it seems at the very least hypocritical, because look at his own back catalogue and look at how he's used the poetry of the glands in his own writing. So again, I'm not entirely sure that's what he's getting at, but if he is, I certainly don't think that he was in the right, shall we say.
Two other quick things. Faulkner actually reviewed The Old Man and the Sea. And what do you make of that? Because nobody was better at the backhanded compliment or the forehanded insult than Hemingway. And I'm wondering if we look at Faulkner's review of The Old Man and the Sea and say, oh, there you go, it's a compliment, or if there's more to it.
The whole context of the review of The Old Man and the Sea is very tricky. At first, Hemingway resents that Faulkner won't even look at the book or won't even consider the idea of reviewing it because Faulkner doesn't know how to do reviews. And so again, he says to their mutual acquaintance, Harvey Bright, he would not know what to do with a review, but he took the book to Mississippi with him. It seems as if Hemingway doesn't really know what to do with that hesitancy. But then Faulkner does review the novel, and he calls The Old Man and the Sea his best. Time may show it to be the best single piece of any of us. I mean, his and my contemporaries. This time he discovered God, a creator. Until now, his men and women had made themselves, shaped themselves out of their own clay. Their victories and defeats were at the hands of each other, just to prove to themselves or one another how tough they could be. But this time he wrote about pity. And he continues. So there was the assumption that, okay, finally, Faulkner has done what Hemingway wanted. He picked up the book, he read it, he liked it, he said it is his best. It amounts to a standing ovation. You would think that Hemingway would be satisfied, but he wasn't. But in fact, the complete opposite is true. Hemingway was incensed because of the idea that Faulkner would ever claim to say that in that novel he had discovered God, a creator. He was frankly insulted by the God reference. And in a letter to Lillian Ross in that February, he says, I cannot help out very much of the true dope on God, as I have never played footy-footy with him, nor been a Cambridge Godhopper, nor won the Nobel Prize. It would be best to get the true word on God from Mr. Faulkner. So it seems almost as if, in Faulkner's case, dealing with Hemingway, he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't. No matter what he says, the smallest thing, the smallest detail can either be taken out of context or be blown up to such a degree that it sort of, his words are twisted around and he is not saying what Hemingway believes he's saying. And it's just remarkable. I mean, okay, in one sense, it could be seen as a bit callous on Faulkner's part to mention God and the creator in the context of a review, because it sort of creates a hierarchy between, you know, the purity of The Old Man and the Sea versus the poetry of the glands of, say, The Sun Also Rises or Farewell to Arms, for example. But on the other hand, if you take the whole review at face value, it is a brilliantly written review, and it is, you know, it's very highly commendable. So I don't know what Hemingway was expecting personally.
Does the review ring slightly of, if you're complimenting somebody after 30 years of a writing career, saying finally you've achieved this, of seeing somebody saying, you look better today than you did yesterday. He's like, oh, what are you saying about the way I looked yesterday? You know, Hemingway is, like I said, is the ninja of passive aggressive compliments. So maybe he's met his match with that, but we'll never know.
Not sure. And again, I can see why he would think that and take umbrage with the, you know, the reference to the religious references. But if you, and again, it would be hard because Hemingway, as we've said, he is the sort of the master of the subtle put down, and he already has his guard up with Faulkner at this point because of their numerous different run-ins. But I think if you put that aside, well, first it comes with the territory. I mean, this is Faulkner you're talking about. You've been engaged in this rivalry for so long. There's bound to be, you know, some kind of barbed reference here or there. Even if there isn't, you're going to, and I mean Hemingway, is going to be primed to think that there is. But again, as I've said, and I will repeat this, the review is with the reference to God aside, it is a very, you know, a very gracious yeah. review. It is not something that Faulkner, would necessarily have had to take issue with. So I think, again, it's a combination of him expecting something from Faulkner, something negative, and confirmation bias, him finding it and trampling all over.
And finally, and I really hate to end such a lovely discussion on such a gloomy note, but since Faulkner outlives Hemingway, what is his reaction in 1961 to Hemingway's suicide?
Contradictory, to say the least. So in public, he writes an obituary to the San Francisco Chronicle in July 3rd, 1961, the day after Hemingway's suicide. And he calls him one of our bravest and best, the strictest of principles, the severest of craftsmen, undeviating in his dedication to his craft. He is not dead. Generations not yet born of young men and women who want to write will refute that word as applied to him.
And he puts that word bravest in there.
Precisely, precisely. Almost as if, at least in the public record, he's finally putting that old dog to rest. He's finally saying, Hemingway is a courageous writer. Privately, though, he starts criticizing Hemingway for having dared to commit suicide. He says to his friends and family, it's bad when a man does something like that. It's like saying death is better than living with my wife. And I've quoted this, and I'm also quoting the rest of this passage from Joseph Blotner's biography. Faulkner was silent for a moment. Hemingway's mistake, he went on, was that he thought he had to marry all of them. The next time Red Hanbury saw Faulkner, the reaction had crystallized further. I don't like a man that takes the short way home, he said. And so again, there's a complete disjunction between Hemingway on the one hand being revered and, you know, praised in the public response, while privately, it's almost as if I can't respect somebody who takes the short way home. You know, it's almost as if his suicide is the ultimate form of cowardice. And it's very striking to me because, as I've said, Faulkner writes so beautifully about the idea of accepting and being at peace with one's death, and actually sort of using death as a means of liberation, like in The Sand and the Fury. And so how could an author like Faulkner, who inspires so much sympathy in readers towards characters like Quentin Compson or even Yulavanna Snopes in The Town, how can he be so callous? And it's something that I've never been able to get my head around. And it's again, I think it points towards this contradiction their relationship. They respect one another as much as they loathe and want to overtly criticize one another. And Faulkner, true to form, if we take Hemingway's conception of him as accurate, you know, he attacks him at his lowest, at his most vulnerable, you know, and not only that, when Hemingway is no longer there to defend himself. And so I don't think that particular passage, or that particular moment in their relationship, the final moment, as you've said, ends on such a dour note and ends on something that is, frankly, I would say quite despicable on Faulkner's part.
As Hemingway tells us, that's how all stories, if continued far enough, end. And unfortunately, our podcast must end with a lot undiscussed. Ahmed Hounaini, author of William Faulkner and Mortality, A Fine Dead Sound. We really enjoy this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on One True Podcast, Ahmed.
Thank you very much, Mark. Lovely to have been with you today.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode and past episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. Our book, One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, is available anywhere books are sold. So if you have someone in your life who loves books and Hemingway, buy a copy or two and spread the joy. You can also support this podcast by leaving us a rating and telling your friends all about us. Feel free to write us at onetruepod@gmail.com. That's the number one, truepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This show is supported by the Hemingway Society and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast. I'm not